New ideas, thought-leading opinions, and the latest ways of working. This is the School Leadership Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the latest episode of the School Leadership Podcast, brought to you by NAHT Edge and NAHT. If you've heard this podcast before, you'll know every episode we try to bring you an influential thinker from the world of education. This month is no different. This time our guest is Professor Sonia Blandford. Sonia is the chief executive of education charity Achievement for All, and also the author of the book Born to Fail.
Engaging content and revealing insights. In conversation with James Bowen.
There is no one in the UK better placed than Sonia Blandford to write about the experience of working class pupils in our schools. She grew up on the Allied estate in Hounslow and was the first member of her family to pursue education beyond the age of 14, and was also the first to attend university. She's responsible for setting up the award-winning Achievement for All organisation, which has worked with thousands of schools to help close the attainment gap. Her new book, Born to Fail, tackles head-on issues such as how and why education has often failed to deliver for disadvantaged pupils, the importance of self-belief, action and confidence, and how the early years is the crucial time to build success from the start. James spoke with Sonia to get under the skin of some of the key topics that she covers in the book.
The title of your book is Born to Fail, and that refers to a report that was published in the early 1970s that looked at the issue of inequality. Is it fair to say that progress since that time has actually been quite depressingly slow in some ways? And also, if you would agree with that statement, why has it been so hard to shift the dial?
So it is the case, unfortunately, that there's been limited progress over the last four decades. And indeed, there's been limited progress over the last century when we look at where we've been as a country in terms of those people that live within certain conditions, those people that experience school in a certain way, and those people who, quite honestly, are not viewed by the rest of society as being worthy of inclusion. So if I elaborate on that a little bit further, the context of this is not just the report from the 1970s. It's actually more recent reports from the Education Policy Institute, from the Social Mobility Commission, and other smaller organisations that have looked at poverty. Actually, not just smaller ones, Joseph Rowntree Foundation, etc. They've all been involved in looking at issues of poverty, the impact on education, the impact on individuals in terms of special educational needs and disability. So we take it in the round. There's been a considerable lack of progress. And the three areas that we need to consider, which remain unchanged from the 1860s, are housing. So those people that come to school, the parents, the children, those from the community, if they're living in housing that is, quite frankly, chaotic, it might be houses of multiple occupancy, it might be that they've been moved around, it might be that their children that have experienced living with their families and living in foster care and children looked after generally. These are really quite chaotic and noisy lives that make it very difficult for those children to actually then learn when they come into school. They find their own circumstances to be such a distraction that they're not able to put any order to their lives. And fundamentals like the Maslow hierarchy of needs, like being safe, having food, having clothes, all of those are, in some cases, and we're talking too many currently, they're missing. The second is about the curriculum, the relevancy of the curriculum. Now, it is the case that back in 1988, the Education Reform Act looked at the curriculum in terms of knowledge, understanding, skills, and the way that they can be developed. Unfortunately, that's been left behind, and we are driven by a knowledge-based curriculum. And that knowledge-based curriculum contains elements of practice which, whilst traditional, and I'm not progressive, you know, people might accuse me of being progressive here, whilst being traditional, you know, they're not really relevant to the context of the majority of pupils' lives. Because children and young people here in the 21st century, looking to the next 100 years, what is relevant to their lives? So in terms of the destination, if we consider what business wants, and the CBI have summed this up, they want young people to come into the workplace that are self-starters, that have self-confidence, that are able to access professional development, that are able to work in teams. None of that is contained in a knowledge-based curriculum. The knowledge-based curriculum is really how big is your hippocampus. But actually what we want is a different type of education that is relevant to today, relevant in a way that will encourage all children to learn. So the third area is, do we care? Now, care is a word that can be regarded as soft. It's actually very hard to care. It's incredibly hard to care, because we have to be kind to everybody. We have to be able to accept everybody. We have to be able to work with everybody in communities, in schools, in classrooms, in small groups. It's being able to accept people from where they are and to work together to be able to help develop as a nation. And we are at the moment, the thinking is very much around how we can increase ability through exams rather than caring about the person. If we cared more about the person, and if we were more kind, actually some of the academic might follow.
And I just want to pick up on the second part of your answer there around the knowledge-rich curriculum. I think it's a really important one, because I think I probably should make the point that I think there would be people who would be listening, or, you know, we know there's people in the world of education at the moment who believe passionately in this idea of a knowledge-rich curriculum. And I suppose if they were here, they would be arguing, look, this is the key to social mobility. This is, you give young people and children this kind of cultural capital and a really strong knowledge, and that allows them to go on and to compete and what have you. So this, they would be suggesting that the knowledge-rich curriculum is the key. How would you kind of respond to that?
Well, I think, as I said, I'm not completely against it. I think and I'm not, wouldn't class myself as being a progressive. I'm actually quite traditional in my approach, but if anybody ever saw me teach, and I do still teach, and that is teaching young people, I am quite a traditionalist. But it's the relevancy of that knowledge. That's my point. It's looking at the knowledge and saying, is it going to take us into the future, or is it taking us into the past?
Fundamentally, your book is about social mobility. But reading your book, I get the sense that perhaps you feel that we have really got that term wrong, or a lot of people have misunderstood what social mobility fundamentally is about. And you talk about, you know, it is not about rescuing children from sort of working class communities and parachuting them into middle class communities. Could you just talk a bit more about your view of social mobility and why perhaps as a nation we have misunderstood it?
So quite simply, my view of social mobility is choice. It's giving the next generation, and in the process, actually helping the current generation, that's the parents and the grandparents, so intergenerational, to have greater choices. It's not necessarily about taking young people into a single direction to university to get a degree, and then to get a job related to the degree, to get a mortgage, then start families, and then start the whole process again. It's actually around enabling everybody to have that choice of where they want to live. In most cases, if you want to go to university, you have to move away from home. For the working class, that's quite difficult, because culturally, it's around extended families and living together and working together.
Do you feel, to a certain extent, are we guilty of undervaluing some of the communities that the children we're talking about come from? Perhaps we're just being a bit snobbish towards the communities and thinking, well, we need to change the communities rather than valuing them for what they are.
I think we definitely undervalue some communities. I just to illustrate this in this way. About a month ago, from the Monday through to the Friday, my working week, I engaged with schools, I engaged with, I gave lectures, I gave keynotes at various organisations. And it wasn't until the Friday, when I went into a community centre in the middle of a housing estate, did I actually come across people who really wanted to change, who really wanted to improve. Now, these are the very people that wouldn't have gone to university. They wouldn't have experienced the knowledge-based curriculum. they wouldn't have had the type of upbringing which, you know, it, whether it's professional classes or middle classes, those groups experience. They would have had quite a hard life. And in fact, I spoke to in detail to five of them, and they had had hard lives. However, they were deeply, deeply committed to their community. They were running community centres. They were running youth clubs. They were running workshops for young people on mental health. They had no qualifications to speak of, but they were there as a team, and they'd received some training. So it wasn't done in isolation. They'd received some training. And they, but my experience of that week, on that Friday, that was real social mobility, because there were people who were saying, no, we want to improve the attitudes, the behaviours of the young people in our community. We want to get away from unfortunately, the drugs that have happened and seem to be pervasive in some communities. We want to get away from the gangs. We want to help the young people. That's not that they want them to move away, but they want them to work together and to see and value the community. Now, I thought that was wonderful.
So it's almost more than just valuing, I guess, from what you're saying. It's about actually seeking the solutions from the community itself, rather than policymakers or us in the world of education thinking that we have the solutions and giving them to the community. Is it about saying to people, will you tell us what the solutions are and how can we help you? Is
that... It's exactly that. It's being able to value. It's being able to listen to people. It's not about going in and telling groups, this is how you behave. I mean, that going back to that study about success against the odds, which was the Michael Barber study with the University of Bristol back in the 80s, that they talked about how community groups took responsibility. And this was against the backdrop of riots, gangs, drug warfare. It was just amazing, the transformation that happened, but it came from within. And what happened was that those leaders in those communities actually valued those individuals, valued the parents, valued the grandparents, valued the carers, valued the community leaders, and listened to them, and listened to them with good effect. And the impact of that was in a considerable number of the housing estates and considerable number of the communities, there was change.
And despite the challenges we still face, and we alluded to at the beginning in terms of the lack of progress, the book still remains quite optimistic, and I get a sense you're still quite hopeful. So the fact we haven't had change for the best part of a century, how is it you remain optimistic?
So I think there are people, I've seen so many head teachers that are absolutely committed to every child every day in their community. It's the type of commitment which provides food and clothing. You know, we read about these things, but I've seen it. Food and clothing for families, the type of support that's happening outside of schools that providing meals in the holidays, the type of support that's providing opportunities for young people to experience different types of jobs that's meaningful, the type of experience that demonstrates that everybody can join in a music group, everybody can join in a sports group, it's completely open. The type of experience where we're just beginning at Achievement for All, which is the organisation that I now manage and lead, we're just working with independent schools and some of the key, most significant independent schools, and not in a patronising way, but in a partnership way, want to work with other schools. So I'm quite optimistic. I mean, in the book I talk about choice, I talk about the challenge of being able to be open and transparent. I've met hundreds and thousands of people who are open and transparent about this particular issue. We just don't need to be in the position where their voices are heard.
And you've talked a lot there about the kind of what happens at school level, and the book's full of things that are happening at school level. What about the individual teacher level? So that person who thinks, I'm just one person. There's only so much I can do. What can individual teachers practically do in terms of social mobility, would you say?
So in terms of what happens in the classroom and also their contribution to what happens in the school community, it's huge. So a teacher that is strong enough to be able to, and strong enough in terms of their conviction, to be able to keep every child in the classroom, not to exclude, not to be in a position where they feel that children can't be taught. You know, there are challenges. There's absolutely challenges that happen in the classroom. But it's for teachers to look at what they can offer, but also if they need help, to be able to find that help. And the help does exist, you know, whether it's through external agencies or whether it's through the system leadership within schools or neighbouring schools. The support is there. For as many examples of where children are faced with, or children actually demonstrate challenging behaviour, there will be similar children in other schools where that challenging behaviour is being met. For the classroom teacher that finds it difficult, or for the classroom teacher who finds it in a positive way, to be able to develop and include every child, they need to talk to each other. They need to work together. I've not, as well as never meeting a parent who doesn't want the best for their children, I very rarely meet teachers who don't want to be the best in the classroom for every child. So we need to work together and make sure that happens. We also need to, I've talked a lot about the curriculum, we also need to look at what happens in terms of the delivery of the curriculum and how we can make that as inclusive as possible. And that again can be through looking at evidence-based activity that enables teachers to be creative and innovative and yet still be accountable. But actually it is ultimately a choice that's made by the teacher. You know, it's quite simply, it's that growth mindset. It's being able to demonstrate that level of commitment from within, knowing that every child can succeed, that they do engage with the curriculum, that they can attain, and that ultimately they'll know who they are as part of society.
And one final question I'd like to ask you is, obviously a lot of money and time has been spent on the issue of social mobility. If you were made Secretary of State for Education tomorrow, and you were given that job and you just had one thing you could do, what would you do?
So the overriding message would be one of ensuring that every child is included in education every day. So there's no form of exclusion. And the way I would deliver that is through five particular areas. One is to really push on kindness. Kindness is free. We talk about mental health on a daily basis and the issue that's facing teachers, that's facing children, that's facing families in schools. And it really is quite a sad situation, to say the very least. We could transform what happens in schools if we focused on kindness, if we changed ethos, if we put kindness at the centre of everything that we do every day. And there are studies that demonstrate this. There are examples of where schools have placed that kindness at the centre and it's made a real, real difference. The second area, in terms of every child included, is I do a root and branch evaluation of the value of the child through their learning journey. So what is the financial value of a child at early years? What's the financial value of a child at post-16? And the different settings at post-18, whether that's further education or universities. Because currently we invest more in universities than we do in any other sector of education. And that group that goes to a group of students that attend universities, you know, there might be other means of generating income so that we can invest in the early years. Because unless we get it right from the beginning, we're not going to make that change. So I'd look at the level of investment if we are going to have every child included. The third area I would look at is the relevancy of the curriculum. So what is needed within communities? I absolutely value qualifications like BTEC because they are looking at the vocational. I value what's happening around the T levels, although that's for post-16 alone. We should be looking at what's happening from 14. We should be looking at what's happened for 8-year-olds. We should be looking at what's happening for 5-year-olds, exactly what's needed. And yes, we do need literacy and numeracy. My whole organisation, Achievement for All, focuses on improving reading, writing and maths. But we need to look at that in the sense of the relevancy in terms of destination and what's required for the workplace and for society and culturally. And then the fourth area is exclusions. So if we're really going to have every child is included in education, if we're really focusing on that, then we need to look at exclusions. The number of children that are excluded that then go into some form of young offending is just too high. It's so significantly high. The number of children that are damaged by being excluded. It is every school's responsibility to take a child through the phase of education that child is attending at that given time. It is not for a child then to be moved through managed moves or through home education or through through any form of exclusion. It just sets up so many problems for the future. If we can deal with the problems of the day, then we'll be resolving problems for the future.
So I can almost hear, I'm just thinking, yeah, sorry to interrupt, but so people thinking, well, hang on a minute, what about all the other children in the class? So if I can't exclude that child, you know, I'm putting at risk 29 other children's education because this child has become such a challenge, and the only option I had left was exclusion.
So then we have to look at where schools have managed this successfully. So I'm not going to name them in this particular context, but there are schools that have looked at those young people that are living in those chaotic lives that do present quite extreme issues and problems, and they've resolved them in a way. They've resolved them by giving that child a sense of they can learn, a sense of school is for them. School is a place that they can feel safe. School is something that they can participate in. Now, in the example you've demonstrated, you know, teachers will find themselves in certain situations, as will the child. It's for the school to look at how they manage that child. But what I would say is being excluded can also be internally excluded, where the child spends their life in a corridor or outside the head teacher's office, and they spend their life looking at windows, looking at doors. That isn't inclusion. So it needs to be reviewed in the round. And I'm not saying it's not complex, but actually the complexity that it leaves us with, the exclusions, is far more challenging than dealing with it in schools, I believe. And I've witnessed some really inclusive practice that enables every child to remain in classrooms. The second part of exclusions is special educational needs and disability. So looking at how inclusive are we? And it isn't the challenge of ensuring that every child exceeds expectations, but it is about the way in which we can address needs, address challenges, but address them in the round without a child walking around the school wearing multiple labels, because those multiple labels will inevitably drag them down. But looking at what can be done in that community for that child to have that sense of a school, the place for me, a school is a place where I can learn and I can understand learning, and to improve the experiences of those children identified with special educational needs. So the fifth and final point I want to make, if we are really going to embrace every child included in education, if I were Secretary of State, which of course I'm never going to be, is the area of parent and carer engagement, and how we can enhance that level, not in a way of having parenting classes, although some people might need those. It's actually not in a patronising way, but in an inclusive way, in valuing parents as partners and carers as partners. It's really important that we see through that lens the importance and the relevance of the parent and the carer to the child and to learning, and to encourage parents and carers to be part of their child's education.
For regular and useful content on the teaching profession, it has to be the School Leadership Podcast. The School Leadership
Podcast. Well, that is virtually it from us for this episode. We will return next month with another influential guest for you to hear from. As always, if you found the podcast informative and enjoyable, you can get every single episode as soon as it comes out just by clicking on subscribe in iTunes. Also be really good if you could leave a review and or recommend a guest for a future show. It'd be very nice to hear from you. NAHT Edge is a union and professional association aimed at teachers with leadership responsibilities. Whether you're a subject coordinator, year leader, key stage leader, early years leader, Senko, or head of department, we offer full trade union protection and high quality advice. In addition, our weekly newsletter and monthly podcast keeps you up to speed with the latest developments in education. Membership of NAHT Edge costs just £13.50 a month. Find out more by visiting www.nahtedge.org.uk.
Every single episode, as it comes out, just click on subscribe.
NAHT is a professional association and union for school leaders. NAHT Edge is the part of our association aimed specifically at aspirational middle leaders. To discover more about the benefits of being an NAHT Edge or NAHT member, go online to nahtedge.org.uk/join or www.nht.org.uk/join. You can follow us on our Twitter accounts. Our handles are @NAHTEdge and @NAHTNews.